This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I am talking to Philip Meyer. He's the author of a new book, as we're speaking, called The Sun. This is his second novel. You may know of him because of his first novel called American Rust. Hi, Philip. How are you?
Great, David. How are you?
I'm great. Well, this is really a pleasure to talk to you about it. This is a really interesting book. I guess just by way of introduction, it's what we might call a big novel. It's about a big place, Texas, and multi-generational. You know, I think a lot of people think of maybe more linear stories than you're telling here when they hear that term. But I do think of it as a kind of big novel in that American tradition. And I'm wondering whether that was what you were thinking about when you set out to write this book.
Yeah, sure. I think I just have a tendency toward books in that direction. And my goal when I set out to write The Sun was in some ways to write a book that was kind of the opposite of American Rust in terms of thematically. Like, I wanted to write something with a little bit of a brighter outlook, more about the rise of America rather than the sort of decline that American Rust covered.
American Rust set in the Midwest, in present day America, whereas Texas is set. Well, sorry, The Sun is set in Texas. Now you're in southern Texas here.
So the book bounces around a bit. The present day sections are in southwest Texas on a large, a very large ranch. And the rest of the book bounces around quite a bit because that part of Texas actually wasn't settled by Europeans or Americans anyway up until about maybe 1875 or so.
Right, and your novel opens, it's in the 1850s, I think.
The main action starts, 1849, 1850,
right.
Sure.
And that where, the opener, I think, I don't want to give away too much story, but you tell the story in three voices, starting with the guy, Eli McCullough, who is the kind of the scion of this family that you're tracking through time. And at the beginning, his story is he's a 13-year-old and taken by Comanches from the ranch that he's living on with his family. Everyone's ultimately, I don't think it's giving away too much, everyone's killed except for him. And he lives with the Comanches for a number of years, 3 years. And as Comanches did, and many Indian tribes did, it adopting in captives and making them members of the tribe. And the Comanche stuff in here is very detailed and, seemingly to me authentic. I assume you did a lot of research on this.
Sure. I mean, it was dozens of books, interviewing some present day Comanches. Of course they have lives just like ours. They drive cars and they're doctors and lawyers and, their connection in terms of the skills and sort of what life was like, living on the plains in 1850, they're fairly distant from that life now. So it was a lot of research. It was a lot of hand research. I tanned a lot of deer hides. I hunted deer with bows, sort of like they would. I sort of went to a ranch and participated in, which supplies buffalo meat to restaurants and helped them butcher a buffalo. I drank sort of a cup of the fresh blood out of the one newly killed buffalo. And there's a lot of stuff like that. Also, I'm a big sort of backpacker, hiker, and I'm into sort of the primitive technology stuff. So it kind of dovetailed pretty well with the stuff I'm already interested in. But there's a huge amount of research just in terms of like, what was it like living in a Comanche village? What did they eat? What was their sort of plant and knowledge of natural history and stuff like that, which was it's pretty intense.
Well, and throughout the book, I think there are lots of examples of research and not, historical information that is contemporary to different periods that you go through. Mm-hmm. But I think the Comanche stuff is kind of grabs you right away. It's the beginning of the book, of course, but it started making me think about Moby Dick, although you didn't switch voices or the way Melville does to introduce all of that information about whaling, but you have that same kind of level of engagement in the detail of his life and an appreciation of the lives of the Comanche Indians themselves, you know, that he, as a captive, became a member of the tribe. So he literally becomes a member of the tribe and becomes a warrior. And again, it seems, you know, it sort of sets the tone for the rest of the novel that there is huge or tr loss at all times. You know, that life is marked by danger, and every success is coupled with some cost, emotional, physical, otherwise. And that seems to be a theme that runs through the novel, even as, of course, he leaves off being with the Comanches and goes back to what was, you know, we would call, in quote, civilization at that time, and becomes a Texas Ranger in those early years of Texas, and then join, you know, goes to war. And I mean, you know, he goes through this long period of kind of apprenticeship for what he later becomes. And were you thinking of, you know, I guess again, this is sort of how Texas and became what it is today may also be reflective, you know, maybe, or were you thinking about this as reflecting how America is what it is today, you know, built on the tremendous sacrifices and ambitions of so many different people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the more I got into this book, and there were several iterations, I really resisted writing a historical novel, which, if you know, as you've read, that'll probably sound quite strange. And the stuff in the 1850s was actually the last part of the book to come in. The original, the way the book was originally written, it was a bunch of sort of modern day folks sitting around talking about these, you know, great men and great women who'd, you know, formed their family in the old days, and they're sort of wealthy people going soft. And I realized that sort of wasn't working. It was sort of coming off like kind of sociological, sort of like this, the author is telling you what he thinks about life. The way sort of some of the postmodernists write, in which you sort of wonder, should this just be a textbook? Maybe it shouldn't actually be a piece of art. And so what I realized is that I actually had to kind of engage with this creation myth and actually do some sort of myth making alongside the commentary. And so the character of Eli, you know, who you just described, he actually becomes a character. I realize I have to actually get into this life of his, get into his head, like learn all the stuff about what life was like in those days. And then in terms of having a credible commentator, because I think it's so different, it's so difficult for us to understand our own creation myth. You know, I think about what we're taught when we're kids. The general sort of mythology of our country is that, which is also the mythology of an enormous number of civilizations going back, you know, 10,000 years, which is that we came into the wilderness, we went out into the wilderness, and we, you know, were sort of forged there, and we came back with some sort of like special knowledge and hardness, and then we, you know, we essentially created America. And this is completely false. And this is something that's quite stunning for me to realize, is that the entire continent was basically at its carrying capacity for human beings when Europeans arrived here. There was no wilderness in America, you know, when Europeans arrived here, whether, you know, whether you're talking Spanish or English. The entire continent was full, completely full of people. And so necessarily, the creation of our country is a creation that is of one technologically advanced culture, replacing literally hundreds, if not thousands, of smaller, less advanced cultures, and replacing them mostly by force or by coercion. And so this story sort of had to be told, and that's what Eli's story is. And because he's taken by the Comanches, which is very common on the frontier, we don't think about it anymore, but it was very, very common for across the entire line of settlement, you know, from Minnesota down to Texas, for the frontier people to be taken captive, by various native tribes.
Oh, yeah. In fact, there's a whole literature of captive accounts. That is like,
absolutely.
You know, yeah. that's you could spend your entire life reading and studying how those worked and what they did, you know, what their role was in the relationship between dominant culture and the people who were in the tribes.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And so I guess on one hand, you have this sort of myth, which is sort of maybe you call it the John Wayne myth, you know, which is that we come in and we're the sort of good, peaceful Europeans, or sort of we fight to defend our homesteads. Of course, we're actually violently invading a country that belongs to someone else. But then there's a sort of thing if you go to a sort of liberal college, which I did, you learn a sort of counter myth, which is that that all the Native Americans or American Indians were this sort of superior, incredibly wise, blessed people who were enormously special in terms of, they just had a sort of wisdom and relationship with the earth that no Anglo or European could ever understand. In other words, they're almost not real people at all. You know, they're mythological folks that you also can't identify with, because they're real people have never actually been like that. And again, the more I studied the actual history of it, the more I realized, okay, well, the folks who lived here pre-Europeans were just like everyone else on Earth. You know, I mean, they were kind and gracious and compassionate, but they also were constantly at war. Cultures and societies were constantly displacing each other. And, I mean, just in the history of Texas that we've recorded, we meaning Europeans, you see the Apaches come in, who knock out all the cultures that have been there for a long time, some of whom had built stone houses, sort of like Pueblo-type cultures. So the Apaches come in and wipe those native tribes out. The Comanches then come in and wipe the Apaches out. They don't necessarily kill all of them. A lot of them then go to New Mexico and Arizona. And then Europeans come in, mostly Anglos come in, and over about 50 to 60 years of basically constant warfare, you know, which in a sense makes a sort of like 30 years war in Europe look like kind of kid stuff, you know. You basically got armed conflict along the frontier for 50 years, give or take, before the Comanches finally go into the reservation in 1875. And this is actually the story of America. I mean, it's not really just the story of Texas. Texas was just actually the best lens, because it had the longest open frontier, ended up in such a dominant position in our culture today, as opposed to like a smaller state or state that isn't as sort of culturally dominant. I think I maybe started out looking to tell the story of Texas because it was, you know, so powerful, and I just had a sense that the history is interesting, but it ended up being really like the story of our country. This is our creation myth. And this is, not that I was out to debunk it, but I was in some ways out to set the record straight in terms of, okay, what really happened and what do we actually come from? Both in terms of the violence, you know, and in terms of, maybe in some ways of the cultures figured out to live together.
Yeah. Well, and I think, It's observable that you, I think you achieved that goal. I do feel like the story is, fiction is not supposed to be instruction. That's what you were talking about earlier. You have to have you have to tell a story, and you have to engage us in the arc, you know, and in the characters. So, in order for us to, indirectly or even inadvertently, accept your vision as you're the writer. And I think you succeeded in doing that. I guess the other part we should talk about is that there really are three voices, the three main voices throughout. There are actually a few smaller voices as well, or less critical. And that includes the next generation down, which is Peter McCullough. Actually, no, he skipped it. He's the grandson of Eli. And then his niece, who is J.A., the woman. Mm-hmm. So you've got, you know, multi-generations over time where J.A. is telling her story in the present. And she is also looking backward into the beginning of her life experience and through the 20th. She's basically telling the most modern story. And so the family goes from conquest of the open range and cattle to oil. And they kind of reflect the, you know, this is, I guess, the story of Texas.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is as soon as you have, Texas is basically kept mostly unsettled because of the presence of the Comanches in 1775. And then there's basically a massive land rush. I mean, we think of the land rush in Oklahoma and, you know, the Indian territories being opened, but the land rush that took place when Texas, when basically, again, basically the 2/3 of Texas becomes safe for Anglo settlement was of exactly the same magnitude. You have the cattle industry, which even though it seems like an enormous part of our mythology, and the cowboy, sort of who we associate with, you know, okay, this is a giant part of the American West. The cattle industry actually goes on for only about 20 years, and in terms of it peaks for only about 10 years. I mean, the whale oil industry that Melville talks about went on for hundreds more years than the cattle industry does. The cattle industry is essentially a very, even though it's this fundamental part of our mythology, is like this very tiny part of actually the settlement of the West. It's just very compelling. So we think of sort of cowboys versus Indians and things like that. But that's actually, as I learned as I was doing the research, not a very important part of history in terms of length or even economically as an economic driver. And so all the families in Texas that became cattle barons very quickly had to, most of them went bankrupt. And very quickly, they either found oil. They basically, the cattle industry peaks about 20 years after the Civil War, and then it is declining, and then plummeting off sharply going into World War One. And by then, most of the big ranches had gone under, and you either found oil or you hadn't found oil. Even the largest ranch today in Texas, the King Ranch, which, you know, their truck's named after the King Ranch, was in bankruptcy in the 30s, and then the Humble Oil, which I guess is now ExxonMobil, gave them a massive loan. And that's the only reason the King Ranch even exists, because of this, you know, they didn't find oil. So that transformation I wanted to cover. And because that also is part of our mythology that's essentially a complete invention. You know, it's the truth of our history is we went from a frontier very briefly to a sort of, you know, open range cowboy type culture, and then essentially immediately to an oil culture and the modern era. I guess we're finding more oil now, but I think what most folks don't realize is that, you know, the reason that the Allies won the Second World War is they basically won it on Texas oil. Like we provided something like 90% of the oil on Earth during the Second World War, and that was the reason. They know that the Allies won. It's also the reason that we sort of emerged dominant. And so all these things that sort of seem like, oh, well, of course America's going to win these wars. Well, there are these sort of very good historical reasons, like we happen to be sitting on what then is the largest known supply of oil on Earth. So I wanted to cover sort of that change, but as a sort of backdrop. But the thing with the Jean Anne character, who's the modern oil woman, is that she is unable to see her ancestor, this Eli McCullough guy, who's her great-grandfather, her great-great-grandfather, in any honest way. So she sees him the way we see the mythology of the West, because, you know, she did know him a little bit, but not very well. And it's actually this guy's son, who's a kind of bookish guy who doesn't quite fit in at the end of the frontier, who is the modern sort of moral voice of the story, who sees his father for what he is, who ends up being, you know, I think we call it now sort of someone with a very flexible moral sense. And in this way, he's the guy who's sort of judging his father and the sort of like, you know, the mythology of the West. He's the only one who has clear eyes about
right.
It.
Well, he's the one who has the sense of tragedy and of a soul, whereas the others are more. I mean, in fact, you have this in almost every generation. At the beginning, Eli's brother is that role, or plays that role. He's he's the one who sacrifices himself. He's the one who. He's more complex. He's more inward looking. Whereas you kind of contrast in every generation someone who is brutal or ruthless, unable to see human beings as other than necessary costs of their own advancement, where the other there's someone else who has the moral center or the and who sees complexity and relativity and is not willing to accept the role that the other one plays. So you've got this dynamic tension running throughout, I think.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, that's hey, thanks for
Well, it's there, you know. So, and it, you know, it make you kind of get that there's this tension running all the way through, and that probably is true of American history as well, that you know, as you say, there's the mythology of the, you know, so-called conquest, but there was always you know, a voice of morality at the same time. You know, there's the tension in American history throughout. And I think that still is true today. We're not one, there is no one single story, and there is a dynamic of different points of view, and this tension between different views seems to be ongoing.
Yeah, absolutely. And not to bring this back again to the sort of old days, but even if you read the sort of New York Times accounts and the what you call the sort of Eastern or Northeastern view of what is happening in the West in those days, universally, the opinion is leave the natives alone. Of course, you're getting scalped. Of course, you're being attacked. You're moving into their territory. We need to leave, you know, the American Indians where they are. This is back in, again, 1850s. You know, the whole West was essentially unsettled by Anglos or by Americans. And then you have the folks on the frontier who think the opposite. And of course, on one hand, it's quite interesting because it's like already folks in the Northeast are taking this sort of you know, fairly moral stand in terms of like, well, those are people just like us, and they were here before us, and we should let them be where they are. And you people just want money, and that's why you're taking their land. But of course, what had happened, you know, the folks about, you know, a couple generations earlier, you know, New York, the entire East Coast, was also Native American territory, and we displaced, you know, dozens and dozens of tribes, small nations, to settle here. And that sort of that point was not lost on Texans at the time. You know, they knew that the folks in New York had driven out the Delaware and dozens of other tribes. And, you know, they'd massacred them basically. And all of a sudden, when it came time to sort of deal with the Indians in Texas, the folks in New York were, you know, sort of high and mighty and on their high horse. So it's sort of
Well, you know, it's actually, as you're saying, that reminds me of the identical circumstance today with respect to climate change and what we will call developing or emerging nations. So what they will say, Americans or Europeans will say, you know, we have polluted the atmosphere with carbon. We need to control carbon emissions. And the people who are not yet as fully industrialized as we are saying exactly the same thing. You had your, you filled the atmosphere with carbon, and now you don't, and on your way to having everything you wanted, now you don't want us to have all of those things. You want us to stop, not emit carbon before we have the chance to gain the benefits. You know, there's a double standard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, they want to have air conditioning. They want to drive cars just like we do. They want their homes to be warm in the winter, you know, and so, you know, they want the same things that everyone does.
Right. Although then there is probably, and of course, this is not the place for this argument, but there probably is a reasonable view that comes in between those two that says, well, yeah, of course, it's true that we already got all of these things on the backs of either Native Americans or on the backs of the natural world, the environment, which we've polluted to the detriment of all human beings. So maybe we can adjust our lives as well as asking you to adjust your life. But, you know, anyway, that's exterior to your story and really not what you were setting out to do. But, you know, I think like all big novels, you know, where you're, you know, when big meaning in this case, you're covering a lot of territory. I think it's geographic, it's in in time, and it's also in emotion and in character. You have lots of big characters who have done a lot, and you kind of, I wanted, one thing I also wanted to ask you about in the sort of modern world, there's a, you do reference the real, you know, real events. I mean, you, as you just talked about World War II, you also talked about how the oil business was built on Howard Hughes's invention and perfection of the drill bit, that
exactly.
The high speed drill bit. I mean, these are, you know, you've kind of, it, just as you did with the Comanches, made this very realistic. It's not, you know, we're not watching Dallas, the television show. You know, there's although, you know, that's another similar area, you know, or a similar place. But, you know, I was impressed with the way that you wove together the emotional reality of these lives and the physical reality that they lived in to make it more powerful. I mean, it, you know, that you mastered their physical and kind of material culture, if you want to put it in anthropological terms. Mm. You know, you've included all of that in the story, and I think it makes the story better. I think those details are important. And that's true also of stuff that I didn't necessarily know about it. What it means is that where you brought in facts and information that I knew was true, then it allows me to trust you in the places where I don't know as much as you do about the history. So I think that's actually, you know, I think that's really good for the reader that, you know, that I can believe in you.
Well, well, thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, there are many different types of writers, and I'm sort of on the far end of the spectrum in terms of I need to know very clearly what the physical sort of world is in which the story is taking place, and I need to know very clearly what the sort of important outside factors or pressures are in that world. And what that meant for this was that I would sort of research some, write some, research some, write some. And I probably read about 250 books on Texas history, you know, the Native Americans, specifically the Native American tribes in Texas, the rise of the cattle industry, the quick decline, literally just about every book I could get my hand on. And for a while, I couldn't remember how many books I'd read. And then I sat down and counted them a couple of weeks ago. And it was, it was about 200 and 225, 250, if you count the ones I got, you know, the manuscripts I got in libraries. And, so in a strange way, that level of detail wasn't necessarily intentional on my part. It was just required for me to feel comfortable telling the story. And a lot of writers don't need to do that. Which is maybe a blessing, you know, because they feel sort of comfortable making stuff up. And if something doesn't happen to be true, or doesn't have to be happen to be factual, or doesn't happen to be sort of realistically possible, maybe they don't mind so much. But I'm kind of the opposite way. I actually need to know everything before I feel comfortable telling the story.
Well, no, I think that makes sense. And it may be that also because in this case, you are going back in history. So, I mean, if someone's writing a contemporary novel and it's going to be set in a world in which they live and they know and they have experienced, then they don't need to research maybe. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
sure.
I think
yeah.
For you, and, you know, I'm thinking about James Michener. I know you won a Michener Fellowship. And, you know, I know that for all of his books, he hired researchers, you know, who did an amazing amount of work, so that he would have all the information that he needed to factually inform the story and, you know, keep it as living as possible. I think that's important for, you know, when you're kind of living in a history, in a period of history, you've got to be accurate.
Yeah, you have to be accurate. I mean, if one thing is wrong, yeah.
But it's not. But it isn't just the accuracy. I think it's also that feeling of authenticity that you know when you're writing. I think what it allows you to do, what you just described, allows you to go to the emotional truth because you don't have to suffer through the details. You've mastered the details. They become part of your kind of your speech, your language of writing. They are underneath everything. So that creates a groundwork to enable you to become to inhabit the emotional landscape of your characters.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a crucial point. I mean, this was, you know, the difference between this book and the things I've written that are set in the present day, in terms of how I approach the characters, there's no difference at all. You know, I approach them as real people. I was very, very interested in their internality, and not so much interested in, you know, what they had for breakfast that day or what the things around them looked like, unless it was crucial to tell the story. Because in the end, you know, the reason that the Bible and all these other narratives are still with us is that people really change that much over time. You know, people were the, you know, you can look in the Bible and you can look in the Quran and you can understand people's motivations as if you were there yourself. And you can look at Shakespeare and understand the same things. And so, yeah, in terms of all this research, it really was just to give so that, you know, when these people move through the landscape, I saw the landscape, and instead of having to worry about that stuff, all I needed to think about was like, what is driving these people and how, and of course they're real people, which is another thing that you lose in the sort of, you know, mythology of you know, the creation of America. You know, there's a sense that, you know, these cowboys or these frontiers people and these especially Native Americans weren't real people at all. They were almost these sort of legendary figures, which is, you know, sort of an approach that, say, like Cormac McCarthy takes. You know, he makes these people essentially mythological. You don't see much internality. It's difficult to identify them with. I've identified with them sometimes. And, you know, I want to sort of take the approach of like Faulkner or Wolfe or something like that, in which, you know, where you're really inside the minds of these people and you see them very much as people, even though they're living in a sort of legendary time.
Right. But they are, in that sense, you know, they become mythological, but they, you know, that's what's important about, I think, the writing or about literature. You know, that's why Shakespeare still works for us, because, as you said, he's talking about human emotion and human abilities or inabilities that is timeless. They're set in a particular time, but we can identify with them. I think that's true here. You know, to me, that's what makes a great book, is that, and I think McCormick, McCarthy, and Faulkner is great company for you to be in, because, you know, they are, to me, the ones that I think of as being able to capture that kind of mythological quality about human beings, but they're talking about real human beings. Mm. Not, it's not a an exaggeration or a caricature.
Sure,
One thing there are a couple other things I want to ask you about, but there was this one line in the book. I mean, there are many lines in the book that I think are beautiful and brilliant, but there was one that, this is from Jean Anne, I think, at the very end of one of the chapters, near the end of the book, she says, and this I thought was emblematic for the entire book, "The blood that ran through history would fill every river and ocean, but despite all the butchery, here you were." I mean, that's sort of matter-of-fact acceptance of what has to have happened for you to be where you are, I thought was really amazing.
Thank you. And that's, I think, the way, I mean, this is the way I happen to look at life, and someone else might look at it a different way. But, you know, you can't, there's no, essentially that's one of the few times a character says something that could have been straight from my mouth.
I'm glad I found it. Yeah, it's interesting.
Which is that you sort of don't, we don't have the right to be pessimistic because we're alive. You know, if you're alive, if you're breathing, you have, however bad you think things are, whether it's with climate change or whatever the massacre of the genocide of this year or this decade is, it's no different than it's always been. And still, you know, your ancestors have managed to get you to here, wherever here is for you. So, I mean, in a sense, it's a sort of very optimistic way of looking at life, which is, you know, and this is something Faulkner said in his Nobel address, was that, you know, humans will survive, mankind will survive. And, you know, that's something that I firmly believe.
Well, yeah, I agree. I tend to be an optimist. I don't feel comfortable with the pessimist, the world is coming to an end view, even though the world is always coming to an end.
Right, sure. Without question.
And just speaking of that, again, I don't want to give away too much, but I felt when you brought up the Bible a minute ago, I thought, well, this book does have a biblical quality to it. You know, at the end, there is a certain, shall we say, circularity You know, in how things end up. And I'm not going to, again, don't want to give it away, but it's a big ending that happens completely unexpectedly, and perfectly fits, I think, the way the story, or the way you set up the story. So I wanted to say to you, I thought, you know, that you are obviously thinking, or I think you pulled off what you were trying to do there, which is to bring us back at the end to what we understood at the beginning of the book.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
And of course, it goes on throughout. I mean, there are similar moments. There's all, I mean, there's not all, I guess the other part we should just mention is not only the tension between, you know, the white, the Anglos and the Indians, there's also, you have a lot about the relationship between the Anglos and the Mexicans who were there in as part of the Spanish settlement of the Southwest, going back 300 years earlier, before the the Americans showed up, and I thought, you know, that's a pretty big part of Mexican history that, I mean, sorry, of Texas and Mexican history that, you know, probably a lot of Americans know about a little bit. You know, we may sort of know about, you know, the Alamo, and but I thought you covered a lot of the actual, you know, painful relationship there really well.
Well, thanks.
So, you know, you had, there was some mention somewhere that this now is kind of like a second book in a trilogy that you're imagining, whereas American Rust, which I have to confess I have not read, I didn't know about until now, and I am going to read it next, but that American Rust, which takes place in the American Midwest, present day, now you have Texas kind of going back in history and bringing us up to the present. So what is the, what's the third book in your trilogy as you see it?
Because this may be a case of speaking too ambitiously before I have a grasp of exactly what I'm doing. The next book that I've already begun to work on a little bit, but I'll probably toss most of what I have, is kind of a reimagining of the Divine Comedy and the Inferno. And it's magic realism. It's a huge departure from the first two books. Both the first two books are very different from each other. But the next book's going to be a sort of massive jump again. And it's probably a little more broad than the U.S. It's more just sort of like what is the sort of modern afterlife going to look like, and what does the Inferno or the Divine Comedy look like if it's written today in a sort of not exactly post-Christian, but, you know, sort of post era in which the Christians are the dominant, culture. So that's the next project.
Well, that actually sounds, I mean, I've read, you know, Dante extensively, and I think a lot of writers have imagined, you know, could we do something like that for today? If I mean, I will be very interested to see how you do it, because I think that is tough.
It is going to be, I mean, there's a...
But, you know, you have to be ambitious.
If it's not tough, it's probably boring.
Yeah.
I mean, I think for me, there's not really an in-between.
I think that's important. Well, all right. So I want to ask you one other question, just because, you know, it's a sort of mundane thing, but if you had to, who do you think today, if you wanted to say to somebody, okay, these are the three writers I think you absolutely have to read, who would you name?
In terms of living writers, or
It doesn't have to be living writers. As I say that, I think who cares? You know, who do you think are the three critical writers that you would point people to?
Yeah, I think it has to be Virginia Woolf and Faulkner and I think maybe Joyce. That's why. Yeah.
No, that's a pretty good pantheon.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, you could do worse.
Yeah.
And is there somebody writing today who you think, you know, has really just got it, that you just admire tremendously?
There are a lot of folks writing now, yeah, who I admire a lot. I think that, you know, we've come through a strange period in literature and culture. There's a sort of like saying or general folk wisdom that whatever the period in art is, it has to be rebelling against the period that sort of came before it. And I think that the, you know, the dominant movement in literature, which is sort of the postmodern movement since about the 50s, has made it a strange place to sort of write. Because there's been this sort of like, I mean, postmodernism is perfectly fine as a movement, but it's sort of much narrower than modernism was, you know, and it precludes this entire range of communication with the reader, and it precludes an entire way of portraying human life that sort of modernism was very good at getting at. And so I think that in some way we've been handicapped the last 50 or so years by that. Is sort of being thought as the big literature of our time, and that you either have to be thinking about it or reacting to it. And so I don't know if we have the heavy hitters working as much now as maybe there were, you know, from the 1910 to 1940s or the 50s. But if I had to name some, you know, McCarthy is one. You know, though I think he has a certain worldview that if you read his works, you certainly get, which is that, you know, he's fairly pessimistic. His view on humanity is
pretty, you know, grim.
Pretty grim, right. And but he's an amazing stylist, and you know, he makes real art. And I think, you know, if there's one book that stands out for me, it's Blood Meridian, which is incredibly grim and dark, but it's probably a perfect book, you know. I mean, within the sort of aesthetic and within the sort of structure that he set out to work within, the book is actually a perfect achievement. Now, is it the book that you would take with you if you had to read and study and learn about humanity? Hopefully not, you know. But right. But is it? You know, right. But I mean, is it a perfect book? I think it is.
Yeah, I agree. I actually agree with you about that book. I think it's incredible. No, it's interesting. I do think that we are in a period where, and of course this is just my perspective, but I don't think we will ever have the era back of big authors who dominate an entire culture, just because I think the culture is too fragmented and communicate. There is no single accepted art form in any art, you know, whether it's writing or music or dance. There isn't anyone that everyone believes either that is great or worth discussing as great. But it doesn't mean there aren't any great writers. It just means there isn't agreement on who they are.
Exactly. Sure.
So it's an interesting period. Well, I actually believe that you are a great writer. So I think, you know, I'm planning on reading your next book, and I'm going back to read American Rust, because I think you're onto something here.
Thanks so much.
Yeah,
thank you.
A pleasure to talk to you, and really, I hope the book The Sun really does great. I hope more people find out about it. So,
thanks, David. Thank you.
Thanks for talking to me. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Philip Meyer about his book, The Sun.